Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. 4 years ago, almost to the day, Leo Morton became chancellor of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. During those years, a consensus has emerged that UMKC is evolving, that it's becoming a more vital part of the city. Lots of things are happening. A new student union has been constructed. The $250 million campaign for UMKC is halfway to its goal. Henry Block has made the largest philanthropic gift in UMKC history, $32 million to fund construction of the Block Executive Hall for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. And now UMKC, which holds a license to operate this radio station, is proposing an ambitious plan to build a performing arts campus downtown. During the last 4 years, something else has emerged, and that's the story of Leo Morton's life. It's a story of a young boy raised in segregated Birmingham and his coming out to face a world in turmoil after he turned 10. Chancellor Leo Morton joins me now in the studio, and welcome and happy holidays, Chancellor. So good to have you here.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's a great pleasure to be here, and as usual, thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, you talked about your life just a few weeks ago when you accepted the 2012 Henry Block Human Relations Award. And I had never heard your story before, Chancellor. And what struck me about it were its two distinct phases, if you will, your first 10 years and then your entree into the wider world after that. Take us back to the Birmingham of your first 10 years and what that world was like.
Well, what I wanted everyone to understand is, of course, I'm not one of those guys who's just raised himself up by his bootstraps, and that growing up in Birmingham and, you know, being in a family that makes the world make sense to you is what it's all about. And, of course, most young people, when they're before 10 years old,
yeah,
they're growing up in a world that's not very big, and they don't understand a lot of the things going on in the world at the time. So you could be in the midst of a terrible situation, but if you're surrounded by people who care about you and who are bringing you up the right way, you're not familiar with all of those things until you're formally introduced to it through different methods.
And your world at first was not very big. It was a
right.
fairly closed
Exactly.
neighborhood.
When,
yeah.
When I was growing up in Birmingham, from my grandparents' home to my home was about 1 mile on one street, along one street called Center Street in what we call Titusville area of Birmingham. And in that area, from my grandparents' home to our home, all of my relatives that I knew of at the time lived along that street. My elementary school was about halfway. And from, you know, from birth till about now, I wasn't actually born there, but I'm talking about the time that I yeah. became aware of where of my existence. Mm-hmm. You know, my first memories are at my grandparents' home. And what I saw in that environment was what you would expect any young person in, say, Blue Valley to see. And that is, I saw a family with, I think I have like six men in my family that I knew very well, my grandfather, my father, and my uncles and the like. And as I said that night, they were all married. They all had jobs. They were taking care of their families. I never saw divorce, so it's just not in my vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
They were all in church on Sundays. And they were all participating in – that's what I saw. And until I was 10 years old and introduced to the rest of the world through my father's business, I didn't get very far outside. And that and it's important to understand that that community was 100% black because the neighborhoods were totally segregated. So in my neighborhood, I had the fortune of seeing people who were – lawyers and doctors, but I also saw janitors. I saw people in different walks of life. I had the chance to see the contrast and understand what made the difference. And in that environment, people always were after you to understand what you want to be when you grow up.
And that makes a difference.
A huge
that
difference.
That matters.
That matters. In fact, what I told them was that my brother and I were very small when my father told us that he thought we could be engineers. And as I told the group that night, I don't know where he got that from.
Mm-hmm.
If you were in a corporation in Birmingham, during that time, you were the janitor, period. And where he got that notion from, I don't know. But it was reinforced every place we went. If we were in the barbershop, the barber would say, well, you're Leo Morton's boys, aren't you? Yes, sir. Well, what are you going to be when you grow up? Engineers, right? So
Didn't know what else to say.
Didn't know what else to say. And then he would say something like, well, you must be good in math. You must be good in science. And so those conversations really drove us. Because in those days, if you were African-American in Birmingham, Alabama, being a teacher was one of the best jobs you could have. So when we would go to school, our teachers would be after us. They knew that was our way out. And you could not participate in school. And if the teacher had a problem with something you did in school, that teacher would just speak to your parents when they saw them at church on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And everyone in the community had permission to kick your behind if they saw you doing something wrong. So it was just a different kind of environment.
We're visiting with UMKC Chancellor Leo Morton. You've mentioned your father here this morning, Chancellor. He had polio in the 1940s and was one of the first adults, you said that night, in Alabama to even have polio. What did that mean for him and how did he handle that?
Well, my father is the kind of guy who just never stopped. I mean, he after he had polio, he already had three children. He had four ultimately, but three of us were already around. And he went to college and majored in mathematics after having polio, learning how to write with his left hand.
He was right-handed.
He was right-handed. Mm-hmm. And he had polio, lost use of his right arm. He was teaching veterans upholstery at night, from 4 to 10 o'clock at night, as I recall. And my mother never worked. She loved being a housewife, and she was fantastic at it and just gave us the greatest home life along with my father. And he graduated with a degree in mathematics near the top of his class. And he later went on into business, and so that's why I grew up in the upholstery business.
So the first 10 years were pretty idyllic.
Right.
And then something else began to happen. You turned 10, and then a whole lot of things began to happen. Like what?
Right. Well, first, I think you'll remember Emmett Till. Right after that period of time, right during that period of time, that was when he was murdered. And, you know, I just saw a lot. I didn't talk about this that evening, but one evening when I was going to pick up my father at the business, I was that thing happened that everyone regretted at that time. The police pulled up behind you because I'm not sure they were all really police at the time. Mm-hmm. And they kind of roughed me up. They pulled me out of the truck and they just kind of
banged your head against the side of the truck.
Banged my head against it and just kind of worked me over with a nightstick in the back of a car, and they heard some noises, and they ultimately gave me a ticket to let me go. But that was later, you know. I had the fortune of having a lot of people in my life during that time who helped to balance all of this. For example, my guidance counselor in high school was Reverend Rice, Condoleezza Rice's father. But I knew... one of the girls who died in the 16th Street church bombing, her father is still alive. He's a photographer, Chris mm-hmm. McNair. And almost every portrait in our home, in fact, one of the portraits that they put up at the event was taken by Chris McNair. It was a family portrait. And it was a great family. His mother, his wife, was one of my teachers in elementary school, had a beautiful singing voice. And to this day, in his studio, he has a sort of a memorial set aside for his daughter who died in that church bombing.
I think you said that Dr. Martin Luther King used to speak at the 6th Avenue Baptist Church, one of the biggest in town, which was just, what, a couple miles from your house?
That's right. And he actually was the pastor who married my then pastor and his wife. And but he spoke all over Birmingham during that time. And, of course, the Birmingham City Jail from where he wrote his letter was about a mile from from my home and right across the street from a park that we used to play in and the like. So.
But your point is, after you turned 10, the world really began to change in dramatic ways. And maybe by that point, you were just old enough to begin to be able to handle and process what you were being confronted with.
Well, I would say that the world was already difficult. My awareness of it outside of my small environment became different once I became 10. And I made the point that 10 was important because there are some folks who have written documents that say, have theories that say that a lot of your character is formed by the time you're 10 years old. And it's influenced by the things going on in your environment that you are aware of. So young people who grew up during the Depression and were aware of the Depression at 10 years old are very savings conscious today. But I saw the world in a different way. That's when I became familiar with the demonstrations and in fact, was involved in all of those.
At Tuskegee, right?
At Tuskegee. My brother was really involved. When I graduated from high school and I went to Tuskegee, that's when I was more involved in the demonstrations. That's when Birmingham became hot. As soon as I left, and my brother was more involved in Birmingham, I was involved at Tuskegee, which can be a scary place as well because it was a lot more rural.
Mm-hmm.
But Birmingham was the hot place.
You know, something else happened to you one day when you were still in Birmingham. You were returning from lunch to speak to your friend Johnny.
Right.
What happened?
Well, you know, this was in like 1970, and I worked for Rust Engineering right there in Birmingham, and I was returning from lunch, and I was standing in the parking deck, and something caught my attention out of the corner of my eye, and I turned around, and there was this guy who had opened the trunk of his car, and he was pointing a rifle at me.
Hmm.
And we just stared at each other for a few minutes, and he then put the rifle down and closed his trunk, but it was just one of those scary moments. Now, I ultimately left Rust Engineering, but I didn't leave right away because I didn't want him to think he was running me off. But that was an environment where you could be in there in what was supposedly a professional environment, and you could hear the N-word being used on a routine basis.
So the guy who pointed the gun at you worked at the firm.
Absolutely.
You knew who he was.
Yes. Yes.
And so how did this impact you as sort of the years passed? How did all this drive into your head there?
Well, as I've thought about it, you know, as you grow up, you learn the world around you and you learn how to cope with it. And, you know, I think the thing that made a huge difference in my life and in my brothers and my sisters, I mean, there's four of us. We all have degrees. In fact, three of us have master's degrees. So all four of us went on to do things. But when you have a vision for what your life can be, you see the things in front of you as just things that have to be dealt with because you see something greater beyond what's in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it was just something else that had to be dealt with at the time because I always had the feeling that there was something greater that I was here for. And I would get beyond those things and move on.
Is there an impact from that man that day in that garage pointing that gun at you?
You know, this might sound strange, but today, if I saw that guy, I mean, I can't let things like that hang on. I mean, as I told the group that evening, it helps when you have a short memory about difficult things, because if you hang on to it, it just weighs you down. And if you're going to accomplish much, you have to let things like that go. That was a different time. He is probably not the same person today.
Mm-hmm. Did it impact you in terms of how you see yourself in sort of society at large and sort of where you fit in?
Well, to some extent. But, I mean, everything about me came from my parents. As mm-hmm. I told folks, I mean, the only thing that I can take credit for is that I picked the right parents. Mm-hmm. And because they put everything in me, and the environment that I was in developed me into being what I am today. So I can see all of those things, guys like that, as just, you know, an artifact of the time.
What do you make of where we are today?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I think in many respects we've made a great deal of progress.
Yeah.
In other respects, we have not. For example, one of the things that I think has happened and is that one of the unintended consequences of desegregation was a breakup of the black community. All right. And so today, as I told the group, we now have young people growing up in environments where they don't have the kinds of examples in front of them that I talked about, that I saw. If you grow up in an environment where you believe that you will either be dead or in prison by the time you're 25, you don't see the value in going to school.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a vision that says you're going to be an engineer. See, today, when my father told us that, I mean, today, my brother and I are both engineers. He gave us that vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped to drive us and gave us a sense of purpose in all that we did for a long period of time, and even up until today. But if there's no one out there that can help you to develop that vision, then what becomes of a, I mean, it's been written that, you know, people without purpose have great difficulties.
Yeah.
And you have to find that purpose. Now, it is not an issue for children who grow up in certain communities because they grow up around people who are very successful and people who are not. They see the contrast. They can, and they don't, it's not that their parents have to teach them. They can just see the contrast. Mm-hmm. They can see the difference. And if they aspire to be like those folks, they ultimately understand what it takes. So they have that kind of encouragement kind of built in. If that is not in your environment, where are you supposed to get it from?
Yeah. Great story. Our guest again this hour, UMKC Chancellor Leo Morton. Chancellor, let's turn to some of the business of UMKC and things that are occupying you these days, because there's so much going on. There seems to be, as I mentioned in the intro, this emerging sense that this campus is more of an integral part of Kansas City than it's been in recent years. Where do you stand on that idea? What is the profile of this university in this town today as far as you're concerned?
To me, UMKC is Kansas City's university. If someone asked me what I would like to have said about this university in the future, I would like to hear someone say that, you know, this city, this region has become one of the top regions in the world, and it was all because it worked with UMKC.
Mm-hmm.
And you just cannot have a great city without a great university. The founders of this university believed that when they developed the charter back in the 1920s during the Depression and when they finally opened it in 1933. And they have struggled year after year after year to really make the university what they need it to be. And I think many of the aspects of what they've needed they've just been here. We haven't really promoted it and talked about it the way we need to. But now it's starting to come together. And as it does, we're getting additional support from many sources because our donors, I view as investors. Investors want a return on their investment.
Hmm.
And what our investors see is that there is benefit not just for UMKC and for our students and our faculty and staff, but they see the benefit, the value proposition for this region.
Clearly, you felt when you took over almost exactly 4 years ago that you needed to build, that there was a need for physical construction of buildings to get this campus where you thought you needed it to be. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, ultimately, as you face the financial challenges that universities face today, you have to look at the university and see, well, if you can't depend on some traditional resources like the state for your support, where will you get it, especially when the university has not had didn't have a history of a lot of investment being made in the recent couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that was started when I got there, and but it needed to be accelerated at a great pace, because ultimately the challenge is growing undergraduate enrollment. We're 16,000 a day. We were about 13 or 14 when I got there, and we need to be 20,000 by 2020. Well, you have to have the assets to support that kind of population, and we really needed to grow undergraduate. We have a very large graduate and professional enrollment here, and we expect to maintain that, but in the process grow our undergraduate. Well, in order to be an attractive campus, you have to have the facilities. We have great faculty. In fact, we have a 13-to-1 student-to-faculty ratio, so we're in a position to really offer students a very high-quality education with faculty, and the opportunity for them to do research with that faculty. And the faculty has a great reputation. So what we needed to add to that were the facilities that would help to complete the picture. So we've been fortunate that we've been able to add not just living facilities so that we can now accommodate almost 2,000 students on our campus, but something that every campus needs, parking. And we've added a student success center. That we just opened that this year.
And what's that about?
Well, at our university, and I would dare say at any university, students need some help with making decisions. We have within the Student Success Center something we call the University College. Now, retention is an important issue. Among students who come to the university without declaring a major, 18% graduate in 6 years. That's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Those students will now enter university college, and they will not take a course that will not count toward a degree. They will get the kind of advice that they need to be successful. It is not that we have students who are totally unprepared. Our entering freshmen are in the top quartile of students entering college anywhere, based on their graduation, based on their high school GPA, their ACT scores, and class ranking. So, and with a 13-to-1 student-to-faculty ratio, what we needed was just the proper guidance. Getting more students living on campus, giving them the proper guidance will help make them successful.
UMKC Chancellor Leo Morton's our guest. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, Chancellor, one of the university's greatest challenges here, and a lot of people may not realize this, is that it's landlocked. How great a challenge is that for you going forward?
Well, it is and it isn't. For example, we have two new facilities going up right now. The new business school building that that Mr. Block donated for us, and the most generous person on the face of the planet, and a great person. We have an expansion to the Miller Nichols Library going up to the west. It's a new 900-seat classroom facility that's that some would have said that, oh, how can you make that happen?
What's that going to be used for?
Well, we do not have large classroom space on our campus. This will have a 400-seat lecture hall connected to the library. If you have not been to that library, you need to go. I mean, 2 years ago, we opened up the high-density storage and retrieval system, so now we have maybe 800,000 volumes by a robot.
Conveyor belt brings you your books, right?
Yeah, within less than 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But then we are converting the interior of the library into space where students can collaborate, and it is a very dynamic space. So adjacent to that will be these lecture halls that will, as I said, one will be a 400-seat lecture hall. We've not had anything like that on the campus before. So, but if you look around the rest of the campus, we have space to the east. There's a good amount of green space around the campus. But we are not just, we are already two campuses because we have the Hospital Hill mm-hmm. campus where mm-hmm. we have medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, and nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have additional space up there. And, of course, we're talking about a downtown campus for the arts.
Let's take a break right at this point. We'll talk about that downtown campus for the arts after we come back with UMKC Chancellor Leo Morton. We'll also get our next installment of 90 Mile View. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about gun control, you can find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, psychologist Wes Crenshaw returns to talk about what to do when Plan B becomes Plan A and how to handle having your college-age kids home for the holidays. Good luck with that. Well, UMKC Chancellor Leo Morton is in the studio here visiting with us this morning. Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Chancellor, how big a challenge is state funding these days? I remember last year, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon at least initially proposed a big cut to higher ed. Some of that money was then restored as the session went along. But how great a concern is that for you these days?
Well, it's a concern to any university that has had as much of its support coming from the state. And in our case, I think it's public knowledge. We get about $75 million a year from the state. So I would say, what should that be? Maybe it should be 100, but it hasn't grown. We're still at levels that we experienced back in 2001, and we are a much, much larger university at
this
point.
Why can't you sell? What's the problem with selling higher ed to 163 members of the State House and the 34 members of the State Senate? What's the issue? Why aren't they more on board?
Well, it's not that they are not supportive of higher education in terms of if they had the money. You know, mm-hmm. and they have some significant challenges, and it's difficult to make the case that you need to invest here because this is your future. But I think that message is starting to come through because, quite frankly, I would have to say that we've probably not been cut as much as some states, but our funding has mm-hmm. been lower than almost any state in the country.
Is generating revenue now one of a greater concern for you going forward?
Absolutely, because all of our other costs are going up. And as we've not been giving out raises, and we need to pay our faculty and staff competitively in order to keep the top folks and keep the university going.
Mm-hmm.
We have I don't even want to think about the amount of money we would need to do to renovate all of our facilities that are aging. I just had a tour of some lab facilities that we need to work on and the like. So we have all of those challenges. All of those are challenges.
And
for
a university
us.
Generates revenue how?
Well, through tuition and fees. But it is not a strategy of ours to just increase tuition and fees. I mean, that's an old model. The old model was anytime you didn't get the support from the state, you just raised tuition and fees. We're very sensitive to the region that we serve.
Yeah.
And we don't want our students leaving just burdened with debt. As I've told the governor, if our students leave with a lot of debt, you know, the more debt they have, the longer it takes them to get into the mainstream of the economy, to get into the kind of debt that the rest of us have.
What is tuition at UMKC?
It's about $8,000 a year. But now when you throw in all of the other living costs and the like, now you're up in the mid-teens.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
A lot of money.
It's a lot of money. And it also depends on the school. If you're in some of the professional schools, it's a great deal more than that. It could be twice that.
Yeah. We mentioned the Downtown Performing Arts campus in our first segment. You know, you and your team have proposed this idea. Some people are skeptical because we're talking about a lot of money here. Why do you want this campus downtown? Why not here on the campus?
Well, in a conservatory of music and dance, it's all about a couple of things. One, attracting the top faculty, because the faculty are the folks who attract the students. Students come because they want to work with a world-renowned faculty member, like a Bobby Watson, mm-hmm. for example. So your ability to attract the faculty is greatly enhanced when they have an opportunity to be around an asset like the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. We visited with Joseph Polisi in New York. He is the president of Juilliard.
Mm-hmm.
And he's there, right there at Lincoln Center. He helps make Lincoln Center what it is today. And it is a great asset when attracting faculty and students. So it's a matter of doing what is best for us. And I will tell you this. If you had an opportunity to look at where our students rehearse and practice and take lessons, you would just see Joseph Polisi just recently said he doesn't understand how we make it happen. It just doesn't work. We're in multiple buildings, and some of the places where our students have to rehearse, they just would not meet our standards.
I've
they
heard.
Just don't meet our standards. So.
Yeah.
We've had efforts in the past where we've tried to this was prior to my arrival, where we've tried to raise funding to modify the current Olson facility and just could not get it done. We kept lowering the price. There seems to be a great deal more interest in a new facility that would be in the area of the Kauffman Center, because people understand that that would be great for the center. It would be great for our students. It would be great for Kansas City. It would help assure that assets like that in the district would continue to be successful long term.
How much money are you talking about?
Well, phase one, and there's three phases, but phase one, which would just involve the Conservatory of Music and Dance, we've estimated that to be $88 million. And we have plans. We are in the process of seeing how much support we can get for that. We've completed studies. We've done site analysis and the like.
Hey, do you know where it would go? Because you've knocked out a couple of proposed sites, I think.
Well, there was about 12 sites being considered, and we're now down, I think, effectively to two. And both of those are – one is just south of the Performing Arts Center, mm-hmm. and another to the east. So this would put them assets right around the Performing Arts Center.
At what point are you going to know if you can raise that kind of money to proceed with this project or not? When's the decision point going to happen?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I'm not sure how long it took Ms. Kauffman to raise the funding for the Performing Arts Center. I would think that within the next year, I would know whether or not we have sufficient support to continue to move forward with this facility.
Within a year.
With this plan.
Yeah.
Yes.
How about a site plan? When will you pick between the two?
Well, that would depend on some of the donors,
mm-hmm.
and the like. You have to leave some flexibility in these plans. There's a lot that depends on where that site would be and who would want to contribute to it.
I should point out that in one of the future designs, phases of this building, KCUR could perhaps move into this building as well.
Exactly. And it could be – KCUR could be early in the process. Right now it's been looked at in phase three, but it could be earlier.
You've also built a new student union, Chancellor. Why did you need that?
Well, the students decided that they needed a new student union, and I couldn't agree with them more, quite frankly. And this is a situation where student fees are paid for the construction and for the continuing maintenance and operation of that facility. Yeah. So they said, we're going to charge ourselves for that because we need it. And it's a great asset to the campus.
If folks haven't been to the top floor of that building on a nice warm summer night with this great view up the great lawn of the Nelson and over to the plaza, and it's a terrific place to see the city.
It is terrific. And there's always a spot up there where there's a little canopy and a table and chairs, and someone's always there, even in the wintertime.
You've also built some new student housing. How much have you added, and how has that changed the campus?
Well, I would say probably 8 years ago, there was only one small facility on the campus on Cherry Street. But then you'd have to go across on Oak Street, and there was the towers over there. I think you could get away with calling that a residence, but... what we have now are some great facilities that, and as I said, we can house probably 1,600 students there. We also have students living in housing just south of the university that we own and we rent, and we probably have 200 or 300 students and faculty and others living in that housing. It's a great environment for our students as well.
What's the percentage of students at UMKC who actually live in a student facility, and how does that compare to... Are we low on the – because UMKC for a long time had this reputation as being something of a commuter school.
Right.
Is our ratio different than other schools?
I would say our ratio right now is about 15 to approaching – well, probably more than that. It's about more like 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really typical of urban universities. Urban universities typically don't have large numbers of students living on campus. So we're getting to the point where we think we're about where we need to be.
You know, a few months ago, Chancellor, you also took a look at changing UMKC's name to Kansas City University. Then the campus backed away from that idea. What happened?
Well, in a process like that, you have to follow the process prescribed by the system. It's been done before. The University of Missouri at Rolla changed its name to Missouri University of Science and Technology.
And Missouri State University was once, Southwest Missouri State or something?
Yes, yeah. I believe so. Mm-hmm. So there's a process that you have to follow, and you must assure the curators who have to approve such a change that you have the support of the faculty, the staff, the students, the alumni, and the like. So we said we would survey everyone, and we would follow the recommendations that came from them. And what we found was that there was just not sufficient support among the faculty, staff, and current students. Among prospective students and community members, great support. But
and you favor the idea too, right?
Absolutely. I think it's a great idea. I believe we are Kansas City's university, and we ought to be that ought to be. It was originally the name of the university. So I thought it was a great idea. However, one thing that we can take from this is that if we had tried this, 4 or 5 years ago, it would have been a little easier to get done. Mm-hmm. But people are starting to feel much better about UMKC.
There's a loyalty to the UMKC brand?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And there was concern that there might be some disassociation with the University of Missouri system. We have no intention of doing that whatsoever. The system is a great supporter, and we are a proud member of the system. And we will just make this university the great university that everyone wants it to be. And the name is important. And for us, we need to deal with signage on the campus. So before you deal with that, you need to make sure you know what the name is, right, before you start investing in signage.
Leo Morton's our guest. He's the chancellor of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I want to end this good interview here, Chancellor, with the Block School of Management. And I'm wondering, how important is the Block School to the work that's going on this campus? Because that school has been ranked as the world's, number one university in innovation, management, research, even ahead of schools such as MIT MIT, Harvard, and Stanford. Tell us about the Block School.
Well, we are known as the campus for the visual and performing arts, but I would also tell you that everyone on the campus is getting into this whole notion of entrepreneurism. This region wants to be known as the most entrepreneurial city in the country, and I think we have every reason to claim that. And when the chamber identified that as one of its big five initiatives, they said that the Kauffman Foundation and UMKC were assets that it would rely on.
Mm-hmm.
We are a very important part of the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Kansas City. And every student from almost every school on the campus is taking courses in entrepreneurism. And you say, and why not? I mean, when you think about it, every dentist, pharmacist, every physician, they will all have offices to operate. And our students in the Conservatory of Music and Dance are also taking courses in entrepreneurism. So they will learn how to make a business of their talents. So it's the kind of thing that we need to do across for the region. I could go on and on about the other assets that we have in Kansas City right here on this side of Troost with the KC Source Link and the like to support entrepreneurism at almost every level.
So you see the importance of synergy here, whether it's the Kauffman Center downtown, whether it's the Kauffman Center in Midtown, Kansas City. You want to spin off those things to make this campus a better place.
Absolutely. And the rankings that have been achieved in the Block School are just enormous. Number one in the world in innovation management research. Our undergraduate and graduate programs in entrepreneurism are in the top 25. We could go on and on. That's very important to this region.
And finally, you've launched this seven-year, $250 million campaign designed to help UMKC become Kansas City's model research university. What, you're halfway there now?
More than halfway there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a seven-year campaign. 3 years into the campaign, we're more than halfway there. And that doesn't even have the downtown campus added to it. So we might have to take that number up a bit. I'm hoping we will.
Chancellor, always good to have you here. Thanks for taking some time
with us.
That's
great, Steve. I always enjoy it.
Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you as well.